Today is Wednesday, November 13th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Coming up, Hong Kong protesters disrupted the Chinese city for a third straight day as they continued clashing with police.
Javelins and bow and arrows were spotted at university campuses, which pro-democracy lawmakers have described as battlefields.
Also, for the fourth time in U.S. history, the House of Representatives holds public hearings on the impeachment of a sitting president. And Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan meets today with President Trump. Those stories and more next. Protesters armed with javelins and bows and arrows took on police armed with tear gas and rubber bullets as universities across Hong Kong became a battlefield. Reuters' Michelle Hennessy starts us off.
Hong Kong's protesters are upgrading their weapons in the latest showdown with police. Javelins and bow and arrows were spotted at university campuses, which pro-democracy lawmakers have described as battlefields. It follows savage overnight clashes with police, who warn the city is on the brink of collapse. This week was the first time officers used force on campus grounds. For hours, they fired a barrage of tear gas, rubber bullets, and water cannon. Chinese state media have said these young protesters were reveling in a, quote, hormone-fueled rebellion. The protesters, meanwhile, said they're fighting to protect their home.
This is a fight for the whole generation. We are not letting those police change our good place, our home.
It's been a week of change in the movement. Protests were usually confined to the weekend. But this week, the sting of tear gas is lingering around universities and some of the world's most expensive real estate. Lunchtime protests have continued in the heart of the business district for a third consecutive day. Full gear riot police are now a common sight on the street, with locals and expats unable to escape this new normal in one of Asia's biggest financial hubs.
That was Reuters reporter Michelle Hennessy. Hong Kong's senior superintendent of police public relations, Sei Chun Chung, said that police response has been appropriate.
Offensive weapons like electric swords, bows and arrows were used by rioters to target police officers. Rioters' violence reached a very dangerous and even deadly level. One may ask, where did all these petrol bombs and weapons come from? Where were they were made? How were they mobilized within such a short time? We have strong suspicion that the school was used as a weapon factory. This necessitates police response and the use of force, including rubber bullets, beanbag rounds, and tear gas for dispersal.
Now, for more on what was taking place in Hong Kong, I spoke with local journalist Justin Solomon. People are describing these weekday protests as a battlefield, a battleground on universities' campuses. How accurate of a description is that?
At times, I think that's a pretty accurate description, although I think it's important to say it's not just university campuses. And we saw for the third day in a row protests in the streets of Hong Kong, including, once again, central Hong Kong in the business district during lunch hour, which, as you know, is like the Wall Street of Hong Kong. It's where all of the businesses are, where all of the banks are, and to have these protests during the weekday impact all of these folks that are out during their lunch hour is quite incredible. And yes, at times it is a war zone.
How widespread are these protests? Is it just the universities and these isolated incidents in the CBD, or is it more widespread than that?
It's definitely more widespread than that. However, it is in pockets. Hong Kong, although a small island, is large, which I know is a contradiction, but there are ways where if you don't necessarily want to be near these protests, you don't necessarily have to be near them. So although they are in multiple pockets throughout, it's not everywhere, and there are ways to avoid them.
As these protests continue, what are the authorities in Hong Kong going to do? I understand they have announced plans to close some schools.
Yeah, so tomorrow, all of Hong Kong schools are going to be closed. We're talking elementary school and high school level. And, you know, it goes to this fact that we saw photographs circulating today of school children in school uniforms being stopped on the way to school this morning by riot police, having their IDs checked and their bags checked to make sure they're not protesters. And I think those images were very frightening for parents, and of course, not a good look for the government. And they decided to call off schools tomorrow. And in addition, you had mentioned what's going on university campuses, and that has taken things to a whole nother level here when it comes to violence, and it's where we've seen some of the most violent acts since these protests started 6 months ago. So a handful of universities have already announced that they're just going to end semesters early and pick up classes again early next year. They find it's just not safe for their students. They have a lot of students that are asking to leave, especially Chinese students who are saying, I don't feel comfortable here in Hong Kong right now. I'd like to go back home. And so they're just calling off classes.
With the uptick in the number of demonstrations that they're having and the escalation of violence, is there any fatigue setting in on Hong Kong residents who are directly affected by the weekday skirmishes with authorities or the use of tear gas, say, in the CBD?
That's a really good question, and it is. It is impacting regular people now. And for the first time, you're starting to hear people at coffee shops say things like, did you smell the tear gas? Wow, tear gas really burns. And regular people in suits. And whether or not they're getting tired of the protests is sort of still to be determined, I think. But now they're being impacted by it. Businesses are shutting early. Office workers are being told to go home before it gets too violent. The malls are closing at lunchtime. So it's now impacting regular people.
Justin Solomon reports out of Hong Kong. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Committee will come to order.
The impeachment inquiry into U.S. President Donald Trump reached a critical juncture today when lawmakers launched their first televised public hearings, marking a new high-stakes phase of the proceedings that could determine the fate of President Trump's tumultuous presidency. House Intelligence Chair Adam Schiff gaveled in the session.
The questions presented by this impeachment inquiry are whether President Trump sought to exploit that ally's vulnerability and invite Ukraine's interference in our elections, whether President Trump sought to condition official acts, such as a White House meeting or U.S. military assistance, on Ukraine's willingness to assist with two political investigations that would help his reelection campaign. And if President Trump did either, whether such an abuse of his power is compatible with the office of the presidency.
Democrats leading the U.S. House of Representatives probe have summoned three U.S. diplomats, all of whom have previously expressed alarm in closed-door testimony about Trump's dealings with Ukraine, to detail their concerns this week under the glare of wall-to-wall news coverage. Trump's fellow Republicans, who will also be able to question the witnesses, have crafted a defense strategy that will argue he did nothing wrong when he asked Ukraine's new president to investigate former Vice President Joe Biden, a key 2020 re-election rival. Ranking Republican committee member Devin Nunes characterized the inquiry as a Democrat-led smear campaign against the president.
The Democrats rejected most of the Republicans' witness requests, resulting in a horrifically one-sided process where the crucial witnesses are denied a platform if their testimony does not support the Democrats' absurd accusations. Notably, they are trying to impeach the president for inquiring about Hunter Biden's activities. Yet they refuse our request to hear from Biden himself.
In an AP interview, political analyst Chris Galderi says the impeachment case against President Trump is unprecedented due to social media.
I wouldn't be surprised if you saw an awful lot of real-time commentary from him during during the hearings, possibly even to the point of almost coaching Republicans during their time for questions during the hearing.
President Trump has called the House impeachment process unfair.
There's never been a president who's been so transparent. This is a witch hunt at the highest level, and it's so bad for our country.
International Edition will have continuing coverage and analysis of the impeachment inquiry as it continues. And you're listening to VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
A Northwestern University-led team of scientists recently developed a method that may help determine if an exoplanet can actually support life. The technique checks a planet's habitability by combining 3D climate modeling along with atmospheric chemistry. To determine a planet's habitability, the new tool measures radiation emitted by the star as well as the rotation rate of the planet itself. The researchers found planets orbiting stars emitting a lot of ultraviolet radiation lose much of its liquid water to vaporization, while planets around stars with low levels of UV radiation tend to preserve their supplies of water. It was also found that even planets with livable surface temperatures could be inhabitable if surrounded with thin ozone layers. This would allow the planet to be bombarded with dangerous levels of UV radiation. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan visits the White House for talks on Wednesday with U.S. President Donald Trump. Joining us to discuss that meeting is VOA White House correspondent Patsy Widakuswara.
With President Trump meeting President Erdogan today, what can we expect during this bilateral session?
Well, there are a number of agendas on the table, and we have to remember also that this meeting is happening at a time when essentially U.S.-Turkey relations is at its lowest point in history, or one of its lowest points in history. We understand there are a number of congressional actions against Turkey, including on what U.S. lawmakers see as Ankara's role in the Armenian genocide. Just yesterday, two Democrat senators introduced legislation that condemns Turkish government's abuse of counterterrorism authorities to target political rivals. And this view, congressional view, is bipartisan. For example, this morning, Congressman Michael McCaul, who is a Republican, the lead on the House Foreign Affairs Committee, released a statement saying that he's concerned by reports of violence in northern Syria and that Turkey must end its incursion in Syria as they have done in October, and has further deteriorated relationship between U.S. and Turkey. And the latest development today, we hear that a small group of Republican senators who traditionally focus on foreign policy have been invited to the White House to meet with President Erdogan as well to, quote-unquote, clear the air. So a lot of things are happening today. Something to note on the congressional side as well is that lawmakers in both parties are also very cognizant that Turkey is a NATO ally and one that is also likely to move towards Russia if the dispute with the U.S. continues. On the other hand, we know that Trump and Erdogan has a very good relationship. President Trump has an affinity to President Erdogan and has called him a strong man who deserves respect. So this is a meeting that's happening when the two countries are not having such a good relationship, but the two leaders are.
Speaking of that relationship that President Trump acknowledged, there has been some concern by foreign policy watchers and members here in Washington that President Erdogan shouldn't be invited to the White House.
Yes, that's correct. And, you know, that, as I mentioned before, that is a bipartisan view. That's not just Democrats who are very concerned about the northern Syrian incursion by the Turkish president. And there's also a number of other issues. For example, the S-400 Russian missile defense system that Ankara purchased. And in response, the administration banned the sale of F-35 jets. These are U.S.-made jets to Turkey. And ahead of the meeting, Erdogan is threatening to purchase more Russian military fighter jets. So this is an issue. This is a very complicated relationship with many players, and Erdogan is starting to see, or will have to see, that when he's dealing with the U.S., he's not just dealing with the U.S. president, whom he has a good relationship with, but he's also dealing with the Congress, who is not satisfied with the way the relationship is going.
With regard to that, since a lot of international deals have to go through Congress,
What is the White House hoping to get out of this meeting?
The Trump administration is trying to offer a workaround to Turkey so that they may still be able to buy F-35 jets, even though they have purchased the S-400. And one of the offer that's given is to make sure that Turkey does not activate these S-400 system, which was delivered in July. Whether or not this will be able to be implemented is a second question after whether or not Ankara will accept this, because it doesn't seem at this point that they're likely to be open to that offer, particularly considering that, you know, any rebuke by the U.S., then the Russians are already waiting with open arms for Turkey to become closer to them.
Patsy Wiedekuswara is VOA's White House correspondent. Thank you very much for your insight today.
My pleasure.
Awesome, Patsy. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
All right, bye. In Turkey, Amnesty International says authorities have detained hundreds of people for posting comments on social media that question the country's military offensive in Syria. The human rights group says dozens of innocent people, including many journalists, are facing criminal charges over legitimate criticism of the operation, which began last month following the withdrawal of U.S. troops in the area. As Henry Ridgewell reports, Amnesty International says the crackdown is part of a wider attack on freedom of expression in Turkey.
Turkey says its incursion into northern Syria, codenamed Operation Peace Spring, is targeted at what it calls terrorist groups. That includes Kurdish fighters who helped to defeat Islamic State. Dozens of civilians have been killed and hundreds of thousands forced from their homes. Amnesty International says criticism of the operation in Turkey has been stifled by the government. In the majority Kurdish city of Diyarbakir, police have shut down protests and arrested demonstrators. It's not only street protests that have been banned.
Social media users, journalists, members of mainly Kurdish political party, the People's Democratic Party, have been particularly targeted because they either questioned or opposed the military operation in northern Syria.
Amnesty International says its figures show 839 social media accounts were under investigation for purportedly sharing criminal content in the first week of the offensive, with 186 people detained. On the 27th of October, lawyer Nurcan Kaya was detained at Istanbul Airport for writing on Twitter, "We know from experience that everything you call a peace operation is a massacre." She was released but given a travel ban. Journalists from the Birgun newspaper and Diken News website have also been detained.
Some journalists who were simply relaying other media sources' information about the military operation were detained as well. Those released from police detention were released with foreign travel bans.
Amnesty International says the military operation in Syria has been used as a pretext to escalate the crackdown on opposition politicians and activists as the space for free expression shrinks.
Especially in the last several years, in the aftermath of the coup attempt, this has become even harder.
Turkey says the crackdown is aimed at preventing the spread of what it calls terrorist propaganda. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
Israeli forces carried out airstrikes Wednesday in the Gaza Strip while militants there fired fresh barrages of rockets into Israel. Palestinian health officials and the militant group Islamic Jihad said the Israeli strikes killed two people, raising the death toll to 12 since the latest round of violence began Tuesday. The Israeli Defense Forces said militants had fired more than 200 rockets. The rocket fire began in response to an Israeli airstrike that killed an Islamic Jihad commander in Gaza. The worst flooding in Venice in more than 50 years prompted calls Wednesday to better protect the historic city from rising sea levels, as officials calculated hundreds of millions of dollars in damage. The water reached 1.87 meters above sea level Tuesday, the second highest level ever recorded in the city, and just 7 centimeters lower than the historic 1966 flood. Another wave of exceptionally high water followed today. This week, the European Commission will give approval to an Ebola vaccine, an act that the World Health Organization calls a landmark moment for global health and a likely game changer in the battle against the deadly disease. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from WHO headquarters in Geneva.
This is the first time an Ebola vaccine has been licensed anywhere in the world. The next step, pre-qualification by the World Health Organization, is expected within days. Pre-qualification means WHO is satisfied with the vaccine's quality, safety, and effectiveness. WHO spokesman Christian Lindemeyer tells VOA this is an important step and a great achievement for public health.
This will speed up any further process of getting a vaccine into a country for licensing, for manufacturing, for having more quantity of the vaccine whenever we need it, or ahead of a presumed outbreak in order to vaccinate healthcare workers and first-line responders to have them ready for the battle against Ebola.
The vaccine, in its experimental stage, has been and continues to be used in the ongoing Ebola epidemic in the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo. It has been used to protect more than 250,000 people in the DRC's Ituri and North Kivu provinces. Lindemeyer says WHO has developed a roadmap aimed at accelerating pre-qualification and licensing of the vaccine. This will enable the agency to quickly roll out the vaccine in high-risk countries in Africa.
What does this mean right now for the Democratic Republic of Congo? Right now, nothing will change because the vaccines, as they are available, will be used. Right now, this doesn't change anything for the moment. Vaccines are already available. Vaccines are already been used. It's the same vaccine, which is highly efficacious. But it's an absolutely great news to see that this has now been approved and will be pre-qualified.
Lindemeyer says there likely will be a higher demand for Ebola vaccine in coming years. He says WHO is working with Gavi, the Vaccine Alliance, the United Nations Children's Fund, and other partners to develop a global Ebola vaccine security plan to fulfill growing needs and to ensure vaccine security. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Catherine Robinson-Williams is 14 weeks pregnant, but that's not going to keep her from tackling the brush fires that are raging across Australia. Reuters' David Doyle has that story.
Yeah, I'm starting to show a little bit.
Catherine Robinson-Williams is 14 weeks pregnant, but that's not stopping her from fighting the bushfires raging across Australia.
Well, I cleared it with my doctors and everything was cleared, and they've just gone, make sure you're wearing the correct PPE, and that's what I've been doing. I wear a mask with the smoke, and my crew's happy with me on there, so...
She's one of thousands of firefighters tackling the blazes that have claimed three lives and destroyed around 2.5 million acres of farmland and bush.
It's not about me, it's about the crews on the ground, it's about the community and making sure that, you know, if I'm able to get out there and do the job, I'll do the job.
While bushfires are common in Australia, the ferocity and early arrival of these blazes have caught many by surprise. On Wednesday, firefighters were struggling to contain 150 blazes on both the east and west coast, fuelled by extremely dry conditions after 3 years of drought. For Robinson Williams, being on the front line against the flames is in her blood.
Well, my dad is a firefighter, my mum's a firefighter, my brother, my uncle, my grandmother, and my great-grandfather was a firefighter as well. And my husband's a fiery, and his two brothers are fieries as well.
So nothing was going to stop you?
Definitely not, no.
She says she will continue to work until she is no longer able, which she thinks will be when her pregnancy reaches about 30 weeks.
Hopefully I'll get there.
And that's going to do it for us today. You've been listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of producer Nadia Taha, engineer Thomas Blondet, and managing editor Kate Pound-Dawson, thank you very much for joining us. You'll be able to find in-depth coverage of world events and news at the VOA News website. And don't forget, with our mobile application, you can download our stories and take them with you anytime, day or night. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Have a great day.